All right. Well, again, good afternoon, everyone. Today, my topic is the sixth commandment and the prohibition of taking another person's life. But before we jump into the meat of this message, I wanted to start with a simple pop quiz. Just one question. And that has to do with the wording of this commandment. Now, you don't have to say it out loud. You can just think about it in your own mind. But what exactly does the sixth commandment say? Is it A, you shall not murder? Or is it B, thou shall not kill? Well, I'm sorry to say, but you're wrong. But I guess also you're right. Because it's kind of a trick question. Depending on the translation you read it in, it is rendered both ways. And a lot of energy and effort and commentaries have been expended into this subject to try to figure out exactly what this commandment means and how to phrase it in the English language appropriately. Because this commandment is actually a little bit of a tricky one. Now, I've read some Christian commentaries that have taken positions widely across the spectrum. There are some that said, this commandment means you can't kill any living thing for any reason whatsoever. I don't think that's right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's some that say, well, this should only be narrowly applied to pre-planned, premeditated homicide. Well, I don't know about that either. But no matter how you render this commandment leads to some interesting debates, especially when you hold this commandment up and you compare it to other stories in the Bible, stories of putting down revolts and rebellions, stories of Achan and his sin, laws that govern capital punishment and warfare, and certainly the whole account of the conquest of the ancient nation of Israel as they go into the Promised Land. Now, of course, everyone, religious or not, thinks that it's a wise idea to have rules around killing other people. Even back in the Magna Carta, they have some elements in that document about murder. And way, 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 way beyond that, in Hammurabi's Code of Laws, there's segments about this as well. But again, when you hold up this commandment and you compare it to the scriptures in the Old Testament, sometimes it feels like it can get a little bit sticky. And it's sticky because it feels like it's the only commandment, out of the 10 big ones at least, that feels like there could be an asterisk next to it. If we look more broadly and think about this commandment only about taking another person's life, well, this is unusual because there are some passages where that underlying action is situational. Sometimes taking the life of another person is not only allowed in some passages, it's commanded in other passages. And God himself takes the lives of many human beings, and that alone makes this commandment very unique versus the other 10. Now, the commandment itself is back in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 17. You can turn back there if you want, but it's such a short passage, you're never going to make it there in time. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 17 is almost always universally rendered either you shall not kill or you shall not murder. And that's largely based on the age of your translation, with the switch from kill to murder happening around the 1970s. The earliest Bible that seems to have made that switch is Young's Literal Translation. The Bible in Basic English has this translation, which is kind of in the middle. It says, this is Bible in the Basic English, it says, do not put anyone to death without cause. So is that it? You just have to have a really good reason before you can take someone out. Now, when I compare this commandment to the eighth commandment, which is against stealing, it's surprising to me that chapter after chapter of the Bible goes through all sorts of case law on how to handle stealing. Very elaborate situations are laid out, and they tell the people exactly what to do. If someone does this, then they have to repay this. If someone commits this, then they have to repay in this way. Now, when it comes to taking another person's life, something that has larger physical consequences than simply swiping a goat from someone, well, there are a lot fewer instances of case law that are expounded upon. A lot fewer specific examples that you can use to build a framework. And of course, you have, what some people would say at least, some conflicting principles. From Deuteronomy chapter 5, where we have our commandment, let's go only 41 verses, just a little bit more than two chapters, 41 verses to Deuteronomy chapter 7. And we get the following. We're going to pick it up in Deuteronomy chapter 7, and we'll start in verse 1, Deuteronomy 7, verse 1. It says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you," then they're listed here, "seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. And you shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them." Now, at face value, the instruction to go and destroy all these nations in the promised land and the commandment not to murder may seem like it's at odds. And people have looked over this over the years and they thought, ugh, I don't know if this adds up. And I've looked at this over the years and I thought, huh, I wonder how all of these pieces really fit together. Now, maybe I'm the only one that has ever had those thoughts. This is a very intelligent crowd, very smart, good-looking, just the best crowd I've ever seen. But I'm confident that I'm not the only person in the whole world that has had these thoughts, where they've read this commandment and they've read through the rest of the Bible and come across a few spots where they had to raise an eyebrow or two. And certainly people around the world have agreed in the past, because this commandment has very often been used in mockery, where they would lift up this commandment and say, "How could a loving God demand that the Israelites go and commit genocide?" Or, "I would never go and worship the God of the Old Testament. I only want to worship the loving God of the New Testament exclusively." Now, I'm sure you've heard those arguments from non-believers, or even believers that want to believe, but have trouble with this image of God directing and approving a bloodthirsty, called-out nation to go destroy and kill, often to the very last man, all the other nations they come across. Now, one Christian resource that I came across when I was researching this sermon, they said that you have to just look to Jesus and ignore the rest of the Bible. You have to take the Old Testament, you have to put it up on a shelf, and only go to the words of Jesus Christ, because there's just too many conflicting things in the Bible, and only Jesus Christ's literal words are what we should worship. But is that it? Did God make a mistake back in the day? Did God soften up as time went on? Well, I'd like to jump into this commandment today, and I want to do that by using a concept here. This is called the golden circle. Now, I wish I could say I was smart enough to think of this myself, but this is by an individual by the name of Simon Sinek, and he's created a whole industry around this concept called the golden circle. And I've used it quite a bit in my own business circles and when I do business consulting, because it really helps distill complex ideas down to their most simple core fundamentals. And for me, when I went through this commandment through this lens, it really helped me understand how this commandment fits in with the rest of the Bible, and more importantly, how this commandment fits in with my life. And hopefully it will do the same for you as well. Now, the golden circle here starts on the outside and works its way in, and that's exactly how we'll do this commandment today. We'll start with the what, we'll move down to the how, and finally we'll end up in the why. Now, they're all interconnected, of course. None of them are fully separated from one another, but they certainly all work together until we get all this focus right down into the bullseye of the center. Now, the what of our commandment deals with the basic understanding of what the commandment says. Now, we've already referenced Deuteronomy chapter 5, which is the actual commandment, but I want to go back a little bit earlier in time, back to Genesis chapter 9. You can turn back there, Genesis chapter 9. Now, this is long before Mount Sinai, long before the Ten Commandments, but we can already see a principle here that God is going to codify in the Big Ten later. Now, I want to pick it up in Genesis chapter 9, and we'll start right in verse 1. Genesis chapter 9, starting in verse 1. It says, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the air and all that move on the earth and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. Now, we have to pause here just for a moment to get the context of what's happening here. At this point, it had not been very many generations since Adam, but even so, things had spiraled out of control. I mean, there was murder in the very first family, if you remember, and things had gotten to the point where God had decided to just hit a reset button with the flood. And part of the rationale he gave for doing this flood was because of the continual violence on the earth. God said that the very hearts of men were evil continually. No one valued one another. So Noah and his family here are saved, as we know. But then notice one of the first fundamental principles that God enumerates post-flood. Continued in verse 4, same chapter, verse 4. It says, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely, for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast, I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Now why? Why is that? For in the image of God, he made man. Now, this is a very insightful comment that God says to Noah. God made man in his image and gave him a special spirit. This is extremely important because this is what separates us from every living thing in the known universe. And because of this, there is a specific type of value that is inherent in life of all living beings, all living human beings. So much so that there was to be an accounting for it. Human life should not be squandered. It was not a frivolous thing. God creating human beings in his image was a unique and non-trivial action. And as a result, mankind did not have the authority on his own to terminate it. Now, God expands on this principle in many other places. I want to go back to Exodus chapter 21. You can head there. Now, we'll remember that the commandment is repeated in Exodus chapter 20. That's verse 13. And as I mentioned on the onset, that word that is translated into either murder or kill, depending on your translation, it has this underlying Hebrew root meaning of something like to slay or to dash into pieces. And it's almost always, but not exclusively, used in talking about a non-accidental death or a killing that was not legal. Exodus 21, that gives us a couple of examples that kind of point out the difference between the two and where they're delineated. Exodus chapter 21, we'll start in verse 12. Exodus chapter 21 and verse 12 says, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. So this is a non-accidental, this is a purposeful death that someone caused. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. Now, it's important to note here that there is that reckoning for the lifeblood. What God told Moses back in Genesis chapter 9 still takes place here, whether it was an accidental or a purposeful death. If it was premeditated, or if they did it on purpose, it was an unlawful slaying, then the offending party was to pay for it with their own life. Like it says further down in verse 23, is life for life. But if it was accidental, then the offending party was to flee into a special city of refuge for a period of confinement. In no case was the offending party not to pay some type of penalty for the death of the other. There was always a reckoning. And this was true for all people within the civil nation. Israelite, of course, but also foreigners, even travelers, whoever. Let's go to Numbers chapter 35. This is the other main section about the cities of refuge. Numbers 35. We're going to pick it up in verse 10. Numbers 35 and verse 10. It says, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment." Let's drop down to verse 15, same chapter, Numbers 35, verse 15. "These six cities shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there." Now, so important was this concept that not only were specific cities set apart, but even the routes to and from were to be maintained. This is the only place in the Bible, at least that I could find, where God had instructions on infrastructure, like the roads and the pathways, and they were required to be adhered to. The cities were placed strategically around the nation so that any person anywhere in the nation would be no more than one day's journey to one of these cities on one of these well-maintained, by law, roads. But in these kind of specific tactical instructions, God still brings it all the way back to the concept he had in Genesis. I want to drop down to verse 31. Again, we're still in Numbers 35. Now we're down to Numbers 35, verse 31. It says, "Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to the city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for the blood defiles the land. And no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Therefore, do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel." Now, God put these rules into place, just like all the other rules of the civil nation of Israel, so that there would be order, so that there would be justice, there would be consistency throughout his nation. And God, as the giver of life, has the sole authority to dictate the laws around life and death. And since anyone can destroy, but only God can create, and since he made us in his image, then God's laws exclusively are the authority in setting the boundaries around life and death. This is one of the reasons why capital punishment is allowed in the civil society of Israel, because those boundaries and those guidelines were set by God himself. In the what of our golden circle, the sixth commandment is the most basic part of this commandment. We are not to physically murder another individual, because God created man in his image, and that there should be a reckoning that must take place if blood is spilled. But let's head down to this next ring. Now we get to that second ring. That's the golden circle. The second ring is the how. How does God expect you to uphold this commandment? Well, Jesus Christ, as we well know, explained in several passages that murder begins in the heart. Doesn't begin with a knife. Now, we'll get to Jesus Christ's teachings in just a moment, but I wanted to turn back first to 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. Now, we're going to start in verse 7, but we're going to be jumping right into a very big story here. Some would say that it's only when Jesus Christ began his earthly ministry, it's only then could we really understand that murder begins in the heart. But clearly, there is consistency in God's word from start to finish. And God's word is true from the beginning to the end. Jesus may have clarified it and put it into plain language, but this was not a brand new concept. This was not something Jesus made up on the spot. 2 Samuel chapter 12 is in the story of David and Bathsheba. And we're picking it up after the deed has been done, after Uriah had been killed, and when Nathan confronts David about the whole affair. Nathan gives him a story about someone that abused his power and his authority, and David gets super angry with him. And then, of course, Nathan kind of pulls back the sheet and says, nah, it was you we were talking about the whole time. So that's the context here in 2 Samuel chapter 12, starting in verse 7. 2 Samuel 12, verse 7 says, then Nathan said to David, you are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I appointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Well, now let me ask you a question. When did David do this? Like, when did he kill Uriah? So obviously, he wasn't on the opposing side of the army. He didn't shoot the arrow and kill Uriah. He wasn't even in charge of the battle. He didn't give the instruction, although he dictated it through his chain of command. So when did he commit this murder? Now, it's interesting to note that there are two words here in verse 9 that are translated killed, but they're two different Hebrew words. And both of them are used back in Exodus 21 and Exodus 22 in the list of actions that demanded the death penalty. Although he didn't yield the weapon, although he didn't deliver the blow, he was still the killer. And it started in his heart long before he commanded any physical action to take place. Now, the heart is where the seed was planted for David and the sins and this whole affair. Back at the beginning, when he looked down over the balcony, all the way until Nathan comes in and confronts him, over and over again, a seed was planted in his heart. It became full grown until finally the evil fruit sprouted into sinful actions. Well, let's go forward to the New Testament for two examples by Jesus Christ. And the first one's in John chapter 8. John chapter 8, we're going to read verse 44 of John chapter 8. But notice in the immediately preceding verses here, Christ is going back and forth with the Pharisees. And Christ knows that they are getting angrier and angrier with him. In verse 37, Christ points out that he knows that they want to kill him. In verse 40, he repeats it again. He can see their heart and their desires, and he knows that they have surpassed this angry, frustrated stage and have moved on into the kind of committing murder with their hearts stage. And even that is only a brief pit stop before they literally try to physically kill him. Jesus sees all of this. He understands their motives and their state of mind. And then he makes this observation in verse 44. John 8, 44. He said, you are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning. A murderer from the beginning, and does not stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. And when he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Well, Satan wasn't literally taking the life of anyone at his beginning. They were spirit beings. There was no physical life for him to take. But he was a murderer by what he had in his heart. He broke the spirit of this commandment just as much as if he were to spring up in the field and strike Abel with a rock. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus Christ adds even more clarity to this. You can go back there, Matthew chapter 5, and we'll start in verse 21. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. It says, you have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. So I think that is clear. That's our what part of our commandment. If you're on the fence about whether physical murder is right or wrong, hopefully that just settles it up right here and there. Verse 22, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Ugh. All right. That starts to get a little bit stickier when we read that, because all of us have been in this situation before. And it's interesting that similar penalties are mentioned in these two verses. Physically committing the act of murder and angry without a cause result in danger of the judgment. Now, this part of the verse makes it seem like that this is just an emotional response. Like if you have a bad temper, then verses like these are your kryptonite. And of course, that's part of it. There are aspects of this thought, though, that some people get a head start. For example, I'm not a very emotional person. You can verify that with my wife. If someone cuts me off in traffic, I don't blow my lid, you know, and start honking and cursing and try to ram them or anything like that. That's just not part of my temperament. Some people, as a personality trait, though, are more quick to fly off the handle. On my recreational hockey team, there are times when the anger of another player boils over and they try to fight each other. And this happens in a low-level rec hockey game that means nothing to nobody. But for some of them, that's just their temperament. Some of their personality types have an impact in this verse. But as we continue with this verse, Jesus isn't exclusively talking about the emotion of anger. There's something different here. It's not just an unbridled emotional response. It's not someone just boiling over. Instead, this is how someone views another person. Let's continue on. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Now, these are two types of derogatory statements. One's like an insult, like saying, like, you empty head, or saying that that person is worthless. Like, don't give the assignment to that person. Like, they're just going to mess it up. They just screw everything up. Like, that's sort of an insult. The other one is more like a slur, like saying, like, this guy is an idiot. He doesn't have any value to me. When you put them together, it's an attack on someone's intellect and an attack on someone's character, even in an offhanded, dismissive way. Now, I'm not an emotional person, but this is not just about emotion. This is about how you view someone in your heart. You may be very calm and very rational about someone, but still think that they are worthless. You can just shake your head and think, this guy's an idiot. Now, Jesus Christ doesn't stop there, because he goes on to hammer home this point. Verse 23, therefore. Now, if you have your mind on the thoughts going on, if you find yourself in this state of mind, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, or if you them, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come offer your gift. Well, why this order? I mean, wouldn't it be better if you were to offer your gift first? I mean, wouldn't it make more sense if you make yourself right with God and then go to your brother? Like, you could offer your gift real quick just to get yourself in the right mindset. This would have especially been true in the case of Jewish culture. Just to abandon your gift at the altar, that makes no sense. Well, this is the thought here that we're going to use to bridge the gap between our how and our why. Because this really strikes to the core and makes this commandment more about not just taking the life of someone, but something that's more personal for each and every one of us. The commandment is very much talking about physically taking the life of someone else. The commandment is also very much talking about having this unrestrained anger and rage towards someone. But the commandment is also about the how and the why you value a person the way that you do. Do you value them as yourself? Or do you value them less? The middle, this center ring right here, is one of the core aspects that God is emphasizing. It's about value. It's about value for one another. It's about value for human life. It's about the value in a creation that God made in his own image that has the opportunity to be in his family forever. Now, if you're cleaning out your garage at home and you have to get rid of some things and you have two piles of things, and how do you make the determination which pile to get rid of? Well, you're going to pick the pile that has less value to you. If we go down in our basement and there's a pile of broken toys and half-used craft supplies, and on the other side is a pile of gold, which happens all the time in our house, no one in their right mind is going to get rid of the gold. Like, they know right away, intrinsically and instinctively, that this has value. One has more value than the other. Now, it's also, though, that same thought process that is ingrained in just about everything we do and how society runs. For example, this figure was from about a decade ago, but most private and government-run health insurance companies place a value of about $129,000 for each year of someone's life. So they use that number when determining if a specific procedure is worth the cost. Are they going to gain at least $129,000 worth of value out of that? The U.S. Army right now is paying $100,000 for active duty combat deaths. The official U.S. civil government value of someone's life is $10 million, although that can vary quite a bit from different agency. And this was developed in partnership with Vanderbilt University, and it's used within the government as a way to determine if a regulation is worth the cost. So they'll look and say, well, statistically, if only one person is going to die from this chemical, is it going to cost us more or less than $10 million to make this regulation? And if it doesn't, then the benefit does not outweigh the cost. It's kind of a heartless way to look at it, but I don't know if there's another way to do it. But even when I was getting my corporate disability insurance, I had to put different values on different parts of my body. So I'm a programmer. I work in technology. So if I were to lose my hands, my earning potential would go down a lot more versus if I lose my legs. For a professional soccer player, this would be, of course, switched all the way around, with their legs much more valuable. If they were to see how I played soccer last weekend, the value of my legs would be close to zero, I'm sure. But when it comes to dealing with one another, it's easy to have this same sort of valuation system come into play. And Jesus Christ talks about this over and over again, where he says, be on guard for favoritism when someone who's richly dressed walked in versus someone who looks poor and is in shambles, or maybe looks a little bit disheveled. And this comes into play in all sorts of insidious ways, even subconsciously. How you value someone, or the lack of value you have someone, impacts the way you treat them. And how you value and how you treat them are really signs of how you love them. In 1 John chapter 3, there is a thread that ties this together. 1 John chapter 3, you can turn back there. 1 John 3, we'll start in verse 11. It says, for this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one, and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous. Do not marvel, my brethren, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. Whoever hates or detests or loves less, whoever hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Now, stop here just for a second, because this word murderer here, this Greek word that is used, it's only used in two places in the whole Bible. Right here, obviously. And then it's used in the other scripture we read earlier that said Satan is a murderer from the beginning. Satan is a murderer from the beginning. And if we hate our brother, we are also murderers. That is not great company to be in. Verse 16, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him? How does the love of God abide in him? Well, clearly, he values his own goods more than his brother. He's got two piles in his basement, and he's selected his own goods and turned his brother's needs away. Verse 18, my little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. So it's very noteworthy to me that this section talks about the ultimate display of love as someone that lays down their life for someone else. Jesus Christ literally did this for us, but others also throughout time have done this for those that they love. Now, we've heard stories of people that will go into a rushing river to save someone, maybe a family member, maybe someone they don't even know, or any number of actions that show love and show that they quite literally value someone else's life more than their own. Now, this verse doesn't exclusively mean that you have to die for someone. There are multiple meanings behind this phrase, but the giving of your life is the ultimate demonstration of where you put your value. You cannot have love for another person unless you also value them. Now, you can have peace. You can have a lack of conflict. You can have respect for them. You can have laughter, and you can even enjoy them. But you cannot have love for them unless they also have value to you. Now, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 13 and verses 8 through 10 kind of puts a capstone summary on this very effectively. I want to read these verses together. Romans chapter 13, verses 8 through 10. Romans 13, verses 8 through 10. Verse 8 says, owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Okay, well, what do you mean by that? If you have love, you fulfill the law. What do you mean? For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery. You shall not murder, which is what we're talking about today. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. And if there are any other commandments, all are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Now, if you have love for your neighbor, they have value to you. And if something is valuable to you, you protect it. You cherish it. You uphold it. It's similar to the commandment of stealing, I think, in that God is talking about ownership and not going outside the bounds of what is mine, and what is yours is not. But first, you kind of have to stop stealing. Like, you have to get that basic part right out of the way. And then you can work on stopping this kind of misplaced desire for things. And then you can graduate to this fuller understanding of the spiritual principle that God is trying to communicate. Likewise, for our commandment, first you have to stop killing each other. That's the baseline. You just have to stop. And then you can work on reining in your anger and having emotional control. And then finally, you can work to more fully understand the spiritual principle, or at least one of the spiritual principles that God is trying to communicate, that you have love for one another by upholding their value. And this is very hard to do. This is very hard to do consistently and thoroughly. And mankind throughout the years has consistently struggled with figuring this out. The book of James is famous for talking about works and faith through works, but he also talks a lot about what we're talking about here today. In chapter 2, he starts off talking about favoritism. And in chapter 3, he starts talking about the tongue and how damaging it can be to one another and how you perceive one another. And I want to go to chapter 4, though. Because in chapter 4, it feels, at least to me, it feels as though James has kind of reached his end. And I don't know if this is what James intended, but in my mind, when I read this section, it comes off as like an exasperation to me. Almost like he's saying, like, ugh, you guys just don't get it. You don't get it. And that's the context of what's in my mind when I start in James chapter 4 and verse 1. James chapter 4 and verse 1. He says, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask." Okay, fine. Let's just ask for it. Dear God, can we have everything we want? Verse 3, "You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your own pleasures." The focus is all wrong. It's inward. The most valuable person is yourself in this case. You are missing the point of what your religion is all about. Now drop down to verse 11 here, because the mindset of these individuals needed to be reset. And where does it start? Where does this reset start? It's how they value one another. Verse 11, still in James 4, verse 11, says, "Don't speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another?" Finally, verse 17, it's with all this in mind, everything that came before it, where their mindset is, where they need to go. Verse 17, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is a sin. Well, why in the world would someone know to do good and not do it? Well, I think the answer is obvious. It's where their value is, or at least how they value those people. Well, in conclusion, turn with me back to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 2. This is not long after the commandments are given. And it's in this huge section of rules and regulations. And in fact, at the top of my Bible, this section has a header that just says miscellaneous laws. Like, these are all the leftovers God's just throwing in here. But it is very thick with specific regulations. So much so that you could be forgiven for skipping over verse 8, even though it's a real nugget of a scripture that ties the sixth commandment with the full meaning of the spiritual principle that we've been talking about today. Now, I'm going to read just this single verse, Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 8, and I'm going to read it out loud from the modern King James Version, just slightly different than the New King James. Deuteronomy 22, verse 8, modern King James, says, "When you build a new house, then you shall make a guardrail for your roof, so that you do not bring blood on your house if one falls from it." Now, you'll remember that their roofs are flat, not pitched roofs like we have, and they very routinely used and occupied and traversed their roofs. Now, why does God care if they have a guardrail on their roof? Like, this seems to be a gigantic overreach, like a micromanaging homeowners association that's telling them to paint their house the same colors. It feels like a nothing verse, like a throwaway line and a very thick sections of rules and regulations. Well, like I said, though, I think this connects all that we're talking about here today. Your neighbors have value, and you should go out of your way to recognize that and to plan for it. Put a little railing around your roof to make sure no one falls off accidentally. And if you don't, and they fall off, well, then you have to hightail it down to a city of refuge and stay there for who knows how long. But it's not about just not killing someone. It's about the value that you see in that other person. If it's just making sure that we don't stab someone, or making sure that we don't fly into fits of rage, then we're going to be forever stuck up here in the what. Maybe we might fall down into the how every now and then. But without understanding and the conviction that human beings that were created in God's image have value, deep, meaningful value, well, then we can never get down into the why. Now, God cannot force us to value anyone. He can give us examples of how other people have done it. He can show us what outward manifestations of that may look like. He can give us lots of stories of people that don't do it. He can even send his very son to this earth and demonstrate this in a very real sense. But at the end of the day, we have to figure out how to internalize this ourselves. Sometimes you got to go back to square one and put a railing around your roof. To take a little extra time in your job, within your family, at your leisure activities, and think about the others that are around you. Think about how your decisions impact them, how you interact with them, how you truly view them in your heart, and if you truly treat them as valuable. Now, there are some people in the church or members that will come into the church in the future that have committed the crime of murder, physical murder. Either it was a homicide or manslaughter, and those that have taken that action, they have broken this commandment. And although the repercussions of breaking this commandment have repercussions that may last a lifetime, this is still a sin like any other sin. And God will forgive a repentant heart of that sin just like all the others. Lots more of us, though, have committed this mental and emotional aspect of this commandment and have felt anger towards other people. Now, hopefully, this didn't often rise to the level of hatred where we're actively and we're proactively murdering someone in our heart. But certainly, this happens a lot more than physically killing someone. But all of us, every single one of us, and probably a double helping of myself, all of us are guilty of not always valuing other human beings the way God intended. The creator of the universe has done something interesting. He's created these silly little fleshy meat sacks out of the clay in the ground. And he's put his breath of life in them. And he's given them the opportunity to be in his family forever. What a blessing that is. Is it do not murder? Or is it do not kill? I guess it's both in a way. But in one sense, if we look at it through the eyes of a golden circle, maybe it doesn't matter all that much. Because I think our understanding goes much deeper than both of those words, really. Let us embrace this sixth commandment like never before and reinvigorate how we look at the creation God has made in his very own image.